When it comes to food and nutrition, our default is to think of it as a math problem. But what happens when the calculator doesn't work? What happens when we plug in 2 plus 2 and get 7? Or 3? Or any number of other variable outcomes? When the data collected is off by 20, 30, or even 50%, how can anyone utilize that data to improve their lives? That's exactly what is happening in the world of food and nutrition research. We have piles of studies, endless apps filled with personal nutrition data that is, well, wrong. And that's what makes the work of today's guest, Professor Jeanine Higgins from the University of Colorado School of Medicine at Anschutz, so immensely important. She and her team are integrating technology to accurately collect more exact food intake levels, measure chewing rates, movement patterns, and much more. And that is moving food and nutrition science from best guess to world-changing accuracy. Today's interview is a free-flowing discussion about the past, present, and very near future of food, nutrition, and the impact on our everyday lives. Thank you for joining us here on the Catalyst 360 podcast, your source for engaging evidence-based health, wellness, and high-performance insights. I'm your host, Dr. Brad Cooper, CEO of Catalyst Coaching 360, and it's a pleasure, as always, to have you spend a portion of your week with us. You've heard me mention the coaching services available to employers, EAPs, and wellness service providers through Catalyst Coaching 360, but why does it really matter? Isn't coaching available through most insurance providers or wellness technology firms? Well, yeah. If you just want to check the proverbial coaching box and say you have it, then those options are fine. However, if your goal with coaching is to fully support and enhance the physical and mental well-being of those you serve, it might be time for a Catalyst, the only national provider focusing exclusively on best-in-class coaching with a history that dates back 18 years. A period before most people knew what health, wellness, and performance coaching even was. Curious to discuss options? Want to find out more about the difference? Reach out anytime. Results@CatalystCoaching360.com or visit the website CatalystCoaching360.com. And now, it's time to fast forward into the future of food and nutrition research with Professor Jeanine Higgins on the latest episode of the Catalyst 360 podcast. Dr. Higgins, great to have you here. I got a chance to hear you, 2 months ago up here in Fort Collins when you were here for a presentation. Outstanding job and glad to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here. Let's do it.
So out of the gate, I remember as you went through your presentation that I had a chance to attend, there was a lot of struggles around collecting good data in terms of what we eat, when we eat it, the levels of calorie intake, the timing. Can you walk us through where that sits, what that looks like? What are some of the struggles? Take us down that path a little bit, because I think, well, I'll be quiet and let you roll with that.
Well, you're right. It's a very convoluted path if you're trying to measure dietary intake in free living people. We can do it in the lab. We can do it in the lab. We can either tell them exactly what to eat or weigh out everything on a buffet and weigh back everything they don't eat. Easy, right?
Yep.
But think about doing that in real life.
Yeah.
So the gold standard would be to provide people with a scale and tell them to weigh every single thing they eat. But think about if you take something from the freezer, like it snowed on Friday, and I remember that chili I popped in the freezer.
Right.
That sounds really good, right? It's got all these components and they're already there in different proportions for different recipes of chili. Yours might have way more beans than mine, for instance. Or mine may have way more tomatoes than yours. And so you weigh it as a whole, but I don't know what that recipe was. So already there's one little fudge factor in there. I have to take a generalized chili recipe, which may or may not be how you cooked your chili. You may have sauteed the beef in butter or in olive oil. Other people may put it straight into the slow cooker without any added fat, for instance. So there's lots of things here that can really be misconstrued in terms of how many calories and what the breakdown of those calories are in terms of carbohydrate, protein, and fat. On top of that, once we get outside of the lab where we can't weigh things back, or people won't weigh things back because it's, imagine carrying a little scale with you when you go to your friend's birthday party.
Yeah, excuse me.
bit awkward. So what we get most people to do is write down everything they eat, or we do what's called a 24-hour recall. We ask them to What did they eat yesterday in great detail? And we go through and ask lots of questions to get as much detail as we can. A lot of people can't remember what they did yesterday or where they were.
100%. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All the time.
Yeah. And then the third way is this, is to take pictures before and after you eat. And that seems really the easiest for most people. But the other issue with that is that we get a lot of missing data because, again, if you're out for your friend's birthday at a nice restaurant, easy to take a before picture. You're talking, you're having a glass of wine, they clear your plate, and we never got to see what was there after. So we really don't know how much of that meal you did or didn't eat. So self-reporting creates a problem where we can't accurately determine what you really did eat or when. You know, we can have photographs that are timestamped. We can ask you to write things down in real time. But there's often times if you're eating at a meeting, you don't have time to write it down right then right. And you do it later. There's life happens, right? So the research I'm trying to do is to use technology and devices to measure food intake and take out all that variability and also the burden on our participants that do research. It's very, very inconvenient to be recording what you eat all the time.
And you showed us some pictures of some of the things you're working on, almost look like Google glasses, that kind of stuff. Talk us through that a little bit, because that the potential for that is so exciting, especially yeah. with the research that you and so many others are doing. But can you give us a visual of that so folks can picture what you're talking about?
Yeah, so there are many types of devices out there. One of them actually from another university is a button that hangs around the neck. That has a camera in it and an accelerometer, so it can measure when you're standing up, sitting down, running and walking. The only problem with that is, and I'm sorry if I'm dating myself here, but if you remember...
I'm right with you, so that's okay.
If you remember Flavor Flav from Run DMC, if any of your listeners do not know Flavor Flav, just look up a picture. He wore this giant clock, you know, around his neck all the time. It was big and cumbersome and embarrassing for people to wear. So what we decided to do was put a small device on the arm of your eyeglasses, and that contains an accelerometer so we can tell when you're sitting, standing, and so on.
Okay.
It contains a micro camera that takes pictures while you're eating. We've developed a special algorithm, a computer program that takes out all other instances during the day for your privacy and the privacy of your friends and family and whoever you're interacting with that day. And whenever you're eating, it takes pictures at about 2 to 3 minute intervals. So we can actually see what you're eating in real time. And the other thing it has is a little sensor that measures right in your temple near your eye. And that muscle right behind your eye actually can measure when you're chewing.
Yeah.
And so this device can actually measure the timing of food intake, which we know is really important for sleep and metabolism. We know that the times you exercise and eat entrain those clocks in your body. And it also lets us have an accurate calorie intake because that little sensor that measures chewing and swallowing, we've done studies in lots of people in the past with all different types of foods. And we found that we can actually determine the volume and caloric intake of food just using that sensor alone. If we want more detail like fat, carbohydrate, and protein, we need the pictures. But just that sensor can measure the caloric intake.
So, okay, so the chewing rate can determine the number of it just seems like we would be so different. There'd be so much variability in the way you're chewing.
No, it's not the chewing rate. It's total chewing, actually. So it's an algorithm that our group has actually developed by, in the lab, giving people food and weighing it back. They can eat as much or as little as they want. Mm. At first, we started using foods that we selected just so we could control, again, crunchy foods versus soft foods versus ones that are chewed and yogurt that isn't. Although what we found is that some people do chew yogurt and drinks.
Is that right? Yeah, interesting.
We found some interesting things. So just the amount you chew, so the number of chews and swallows, actually we can determine a mass or a volume of food. The other thing that this device lets us do that we never could do before is understand the context in which you're eating, which is really important. We know that if you eat with friends and family, right, you eat more. If you and I are having a great conversation and there's food in front of us, we'll probably eat absentmindedly and eat more than if we were sitting alone at the dinner table. But also we can measure how much people eat in their cars, which has not really been recorded accurately before. The validated way to do this with self-reported measures that we talked about is for people to choose from a list that was simply at home, in a restaurant, outdoors, transportation, right? I eat very differently on a 5-hour flight to Boston than I do, you know, in my car on the way to tennis, for instance. Right. So transportation can be quite a different scenario. So we've actually been able to look at the context in which people are eating for the very first time.
So a lot of follow-up questions to that. One, the eating in car, I remember seeing a statistic from, I think it was McDonald's, that said their second most popular time to sell milkshakes was morning. And I thought, ew, that sounds nasty. But what folks were doing is they were treating a chocolate shake as their breakfast because it gave them the calorie intake. They wouldn't spill it on their dress, their suit, whatever they were wearing to work. Is that what you're finding? Is that the car becomes the very dense calorie intake versus other places maybe it's not as dense?
We don't know yet. So what we did first was go back to the studies we'd already conducted and just characterize all these different environments so that for the upcoming study that we're about to do, we can actually look at those things. We can actually you correlate people's food choices and amount eaten with the environment. Our first job was to say, what should really be our list? How granular should we break it down? Yeah. And so on. So, but we did find people snacking a lot in their cars. So, and again, it's sort of like you and I having a scintillating conversation and just picking food from the table. You're otherwise occupied. There's food in your cup holder. And so possibly we would assume or hypothesize that people do eat more calories that way.
So I want to get into, well, I'll just ask it right off the top. How do people interpret all these food studies that they're either reading abstracts about or hearing people highlight? Because there are so many of them, and yet we're hearing you say, you know, Brad, I don't know if the data is that good because of all these XYZ struggles. How do we interpret these things from a lay perspective?
Right. I think that any study that's conducted rigorously via a standardized scientific method using validated tools to measure intake, so the tools that I mentioned, the 24-hour recall, diet diaries, weighed food records, and photographic food records, they're the validated methods we have right now, and they are the best data we have. So I'm not saying discount these entirely. What I'm saying is we can do better, and we can do better in terms of accuracy of data. We can do better for all the people that are in our studies. Can you imagine, Brad, spending 2 weeks writing down everything you eat? Boy, we can do better by the people who are really volunteering their time to us, I think.
Well, and you even get some of the anomalies in there. You just talked about when you're on your way to go play tennis. So let's say you are playing tennis. You're not going to wear that clock or that camera. Let's say you've got a little Gatorade or something that you like when you're playing on a hot day, that's probably going to get left off. So even those elements are, very significant. Let's go through each one of these and talk about, are there ways to improve them outside of the technology element, or is this as good as it can get? So the recipe, your chili example, you and I both say we had chili, but there's a range. Are there ways to improve that? Is there a broader range? Is there more options, but then you get less accuracy on me as the user because there were 17 chilies and I'm like, whatever, I'll just pick the first one. Are there ways to improve that piece first?
Yeah, this is actually a big part of our research, and I have to compliment my team here. Doing methodological research is not, you know, the thing people go to college for. It's not exciting. They want to find out the thing that drives energy expenditure so you can help people exercise more efficiently or develop the exercise, right? You don't go to say, I want to look at the nuances of how to measure these things. Right. So they've done this work extensively. And what we've done is found that there is a lot of variability. If we take just one written diet record, so if we take Brad's diet record mm-hmm. from yesterday mm-hmm. and I get three operators to enter it. Even with very strong standard operating procedures, we get some variability depending on, again, which version of chili we chose, what pizza we thought you were eating, right. And so on. So the pictures really help with that because we can see brand, we can see size. If you just write it down, I'm relying on you writing down the correct size. Right. And then what we can do is go in and say, what are the new sources of variability now? And what we found is by accurately choosing, I'm going to give pizza as an example because in most of our studies, that's one of the most frequently eaten foods is pizza. And, you know, if you look at the food databases we use, that's another source of accuracy problems. And that is that there are about 24 or 28 types of pizza I can choose. Now, you can divide that by small, medium, large, and extra large. So let's say there's about six or seven of each crust type, size, and topping. And we found that when we entered what we saw, that led some really big variability because if I can see that it's brand X and I enter that, that's probably accurate, sort of. If I can't see a brand, if I've gone and bought a slice and you see it on a plate or I put it in the oven from a store and you don't know where I bought it from, right, because you just saw me get it out of the oven and start eating it, we have to choose a generic type of pizza of the same size and topping. Those two things in the database we use, which is from the USDA, the US Department of Agriculture, it's the gold standard database for North America, can differ in calories by 300 a slice.
Wow.
It might not be 300, about 240 a slice. And most people don't eat one slice of pizza. So just at that one meal, you're getting loads of variation. So one of the methodological things we've done is go through these very commonly consumed energy dense foods and choose one single item that all of our nutritionists will enter. And whilst that might not be especially accurate for Brad versus Janine, what it does in terms of a study is overall for the population for the study, that will give us a more accurate and precise answer. So we've done these little minute things that sound so small, but make a really big difference in terms of the data at the end.
Well, when you were talking about the pictures, and I think you mentioned this in your lecture as well, the time involved in looking at every single one of those is got to be just exorbitant.
It's mind blowing. Again, I have to congratulate my team at the CCTSI Nutrition Corps. They sit and look through hundreds of these every week, and they're very knowledgeable.
Right.
And even then, in these cases, it can be hard because depending on your cultural context of food, identifying a food can be quite difficult. So, for instance, in one picture, when we all looked at it as a group, someone saw an item as half a bratwurst that had been grilled to brown, and someone saw it as a grilled plantain. And if you don't go in and zoom in and take the time to really see the texture and what it is, those two people would have recorded dramatically different things. So it's not just quickly looking at a picture like you think. I mean, it's a lot of detailed looking and zooming. So they do a great job.
And are you finding any practical aspects from, and I jotted down, you were talking about when you eat alone versus with others, when you eat in your car versus at home. Were there any things that came out of that on a 10,000 foot scale or view where you said, oh, this is fascinating data that we're collecting here?
No, because that's what we're doing right now. So again, we didn't look at the behaviors. We just categorized how we were going to record those behaviors. So now we're really looking into the timing, the context, the place, the people. I've got another colleague in Boston who's on the grant to look at developing this device to measure food intake. And she looks specifically at screen time and food intake. So she's looking at screen time and food intake, and we're looking at where are you and who are you with.
Right.
So we're about to embark on learning a lot more about behavior, I believe.
And we're just talking hypothesis now, but I'm thinking it might go both ways. You might choose, you might be more likely to eat your salad if you're reading something on your computer at lunch versus choosing the higher dense tastier food because you don't care as much, and you probably eat more because you don't realize when you're full. Is that the hypothesis you're going in with, or is that what you've seen in the literature that's leading up to what your research is going to look at?
Yeah. So the past literature, which I need to make sure people understand, is mostly in lab settings. So an artificial setting or a semi-lab setting where they're being recorded in a more natural type of environment, but still not out in the wild. And yes, we do say that people are out in the wild. Lab studies versus free living or in the wild.
I love that.
We can't really mimic what people do in the wild. But studies do show that those that eat more quickly generally take in more calories, more energy. When you eat with people, you tend to take in more calories. And people who eat late at night tend to overeat. They use more energy to stay up longer if they have a longer wake time, if they're awake late at night and up again early in the morning. But they actually overcompensate for the amount of calories they're burning to stay awake. And most of that is eaten as carbohydrates. So we do know some things about people's eating behavior, but we need a lot more detail about the context. So the thing about eating more carbohydrates, if you stay up later at night, that's completely on an inpatient setting in the hospital. Everything is controlled. So is that true if it's not just you staying up late? You're staying up late playing video games with your buddies,
right?
There's going to be all these nuances that we're just so excited to have the opportunity now to learn about.
How far out do you, and I know everything, it's like having your kitchen redone, it always takes twice as long, it takes and costs twice as much. But what's your guess on when we'll start having some of your studies being out there, maybe not quite published, but at least some of the early work being released?
Not long now. So we're recruiting to start early next year a study called the JITAI study, Just in Time Adaptive Intervention. And what that is looking at is using feedback from a cell phone that's linked to our device on the glasses. So when the glasses see you eating, and this is going to be in people with overweight or obesity. And we want to take, again, we're always about taking the work out of life, right? Let's make life simple.
Yeah.
So what those folks are going to be doing is eating normally. We're going to ask them to eat about 500 kcals less a day, which is the standard dietary recommendation for any sort of weight loss program. But we're not going to ask them to do anything out of the ordinary for themselves. They can eat whatever they want, go wherever they want, do whatever they want. They're wearing our device on the glasses. And the cell phone will say to them at each meal, you're approaching your target or your goal for this meal. Are you full? Simple things like that. We created hundreds of messages, but because we can't give you the same message every time for every meal for a few weeks, right? You just turn your phone off and throw it away. But really saying to people, it's your choice. And we're using cognitive behavioral science to develop the messages and so on, so that they resonate with people. We've done a whole survey of hundreds of people around the country for all the messages to see if they find them acceptable or do they think they're judgy? Do they think they would respond positively to that message in terms of doing what the message asks?
Right.
But actually the messages don't ask anything. They prompt you to think about for yourself.
They're reflective.
Do I want to keep eating?
Yeah.
So in that study, we have a whole new bunch of participants, mostly from Boston and Rhode Island, because they're our two clinical sites right now. And we're going to get all those data in the first half of next year and start analyzing them in these contexts and look at the behavior as well as just the caloric intake, and did this feedback mechanism resonate with people and work for them?
And just that statement there gets me thinking about all the other variables that you're having to deal with in your research of a person that lives in Boston might be very different than a person that lives in Iowa or Fort Collins. Or are you able to, I mean, you can't have huge sample sizes because of all the work that's involved in tracking this. Are you able to filter that out, or is that Brad, we're going to get that down the road. We need to get this part first.
Yeah. For the first study about the messaging and feedback, that was from people all over the country, very, very disparate sample because it was a questionnaire study. This is the first study of this kind that we have done. So again, we have to recruit from sites that we know. But the good thing is the populations of those two cities are quite different. So we should get some diversity of participant recruitment. But again, it will be interesting to expand in the future and really look at different types of communities, because everybody has a different way of eating, a different cultural background that they're bringing to food, and their own personal stage of life, right? So how I ate this month was not how I ate in July.
100%. And even beyond stage of life, things like how well did you sleep in the last 2 or 3 days has an influence on our intake of high calorie versus, in quotes, healthier choices. Any chance you're collecting that type of data along with this in terms of exercise routines, sleep habits, those kinds of things?
We will not be collecting. We'll be collecting those things via questionnaire, which is not the gold standard. Again, this is pretty intense to do all this and to get all these devices to people and get them to wear them for 100%. Weeks. And so we're focusing on the food intake aspect first, but there is so much more work to do. You're exactly right. It's, you know, we need to look at this in combination with exercise. Because this has an accelerometer. We may in the future be able to combine an exercise and dietary intake type of model, which is the goal long term. But we just need to look at one thing at a time to see where our theories pan out and where they don't.
Right. No doubt. My professors always got on me for saying, "Oh, we should look at this," and they're like, "Brad, we need to look at 1 to 2 things. You can't track all of that. That's not a study. That's just a game." I'm hoping somebody hears this and like contacts you and says, "We need to support what you're doing here," because if we can get this technology in place, that opens such opportunity on so many planes. I mean, this is really exciting. Have you had this vision for a decade, a year? Did it come up last week? Like, when did you start thinking we can combine technology with your biochemistry background? Like, that's not, I don't think a biochemist sitting back and going, "So the technology we could do that." How did this come to be?
Well, it's a team as always. And it was an engineer who thought of this idea, right?
Of course.
But he doesn't do nutrition or recruit people to studies. Right. He makes devices and does algorithms. So he needed people on his team that do what I do, and I needed the device to do what I do. So we just created this wonderful partnership about 10 years ago, and it started off, I wish your listeners could see pictures. It was horrendous. It started off with this big muffled neoprene cuff right around the neck with a microphone in it to hear the swallows, and this strain gauge that went from your jaw behind your ear down to your hairline. So it was, and it was stuck on with, you know, medical adhesive. It was very uncomfortable.
Not exactly again, free living at that point.
No. This was not in the wild by any stretch. This was in the lab. But you need these kinds of studies to just see if a device like this could measure what we wanted to measure, or was it a waste of time? So it's been very sequential. And then once we got to the engineer came up with the idea of attaching something to eyeglasses. And for those who don't wear eyeglasses, we actually do provide, you know, the glasses with no magnification, the readers with zero magnification. So we call them fun glasses. They're what people use on Halloween. He came up with this idea. And since then, that was about 6 years ago, we've done a lot of work looking at in the lab, transitioning to that to semi-free living. So a day eating in the lab, but bringing any food you want to eat, then 2 days outside of the lab to check that we can really get accurate intake data. And that's us weighing all the food back every meal, every day. Participant didn't have to do it, we did. Then transitioning to fully free living in the wild and checking that we were still getting accurate data with photographic food records now as our standard, because we're not getting everything weighed. So it's been an odyssey. And over whilst we were refining our nutrition methods, the engineers have been getting the device smaller and smaller, developing better and better algorithms to measure the volume of food intake using the device.
You're talking about the fun glasses. One of my roommates, I went to physical therapy school after a degree in biology out of the gate, 35 years ago. That's crazy to say. But he wore those glasses because he felt like it made him look more professional. So we always gave him a hard time. We're like, we didn't know you wore glasses. He goes, well, I don't really, but you know, these are, I got these at such and such place. So question, what have you found? I wrote down the three things that you look at is typically comparing to the recipes, the 24-hour recall, and then the pictures. As you compared, I think you've done this, so tell me if I'm wrong, but as you compared the pictures to their recall, how much variability did you tend to see with that? Because, you know, the old saying is we always overestimate how much we work and we, you know, and how much we should be paid. And we underestimate by far how many calories we eat. And we overestimate how much we exercise and how intense, but we underestimate our, on and on and on.
Yeah.
What did you find that was the case, that we're way off when we self-report?
Yeah. Yeah, in our lab and semi-free living study, people recording what they ate with excellent instructions and right after the meal, which is optimal. We know that people in the wild do not record right at every single meal. We found out that their estimates of what they were eating were about 20% off, sometimes some people up to 50% off. It just depends. And, you know, people always think it's some element of reporting bias where people want to be perceived as eating a certain way or whatever. But a lot of it, Brad, is think about how many people don't cook or bake. Mm-hmm. So when I'm asking you to write down and estimate the volumes of what you're eating, that's very, very, very difficult. Right. And I think that, again, I think it's a lot to ask of people. I cook all the time, but if you ask me to sit down and look at a plate of food and estimate, and I've been doing this for a long time, it's, I've still got to, you know, sit back and think very carefully. And our metabolic kitchen with the CCTSI nutrition core weighs everything in grams, which is much more accurate than in ounces, pounds and ounces. So I probably have a more refined scale to measure these things on, and I still have difficulty. So some of it probably is reporting bias, but a lot of it is, it's just really hard to do.
Right. Well, and I think that's a great reminder to folks out there that are either personally trying to track their food intake or their coaches or nutritionists having their clients do this. We're talking about a relatively small window of time with very good instructions, and they're still off 20 to 50%. Keep that in mind, folks, when you're doing that with yourself and you're looking at saying, well, I don't know why it's not making a difference. Well, maybe we're not keeping the data the way we could. And again, that's not pointing to that individual. It's just saying the reality is, even when you have great instructions and you're doing your best, you're off 20 to 50%. So give yourself some grace on that and the realization that we're probably not that accurate when we are doing the self-recall or the tracking with that, even if we have the right recipes.
And some of the back end data, Brad, is calculated by the USDA by these generalized recipe ideas. There are only 64 foods that are actually measured in the lab for their energy and fat and carbohydrate and protein levels. All the others are calculated from those foods. So there's all these factors along the way. So don't beat yourself up if you think you're doing a 500 kcal deficit to lose weight, or you're actually in a muscle building phase going into cycling season and you want to up by 600 or 700 calories, right? And yet you still are losing muscle mass as you ramp up your exercise, or you're trying to decrease calories and you're not losing weight like you thought. Really think that, you know, it's not you, you're not doing anything wrong. You just need to further adjust, right? And that's probably not the answer people want to hear, but a lot of years with and struggling with weight myself, honestly, over my whole life, even though I've been quite active most of my life. Really, if I think I'm decreasing calories and I'm exercising enough and I'm not, and again, not necessarily even weighing myself, just my pants fit exactly the same as they did 3 weeks ago.
Right.
I'm like, then I just got to do something else. I got to eat less, no matter what I think is happening. And it's not because I'm not doing my best. I am, but I'm probably overthinking it, right? I'm not seeing the difference I want. I've got to adapt. And it, honestly, to everyone out there, it is very hard to do. Yes. So give yourself some grace. I think that's great advice.
Yeah, no doubt. You got me thinking about something, and then I was so tuned into what you're saying. Well, let's go this route. surprises? What, as you go through your research, what are some of the things that you go, huh, I didn't expect that? And by the same token, what are some things that you're confirming that you did expect to see as you went through this?
I think one of the things that really surprised me is some of the messages that didn't resonate with people that we thought were very pedestrian and positive. And participants were saying, no, that's judgy. I wouldn't do what that message wanted me to do.
Interesting.
But I think part of this, Brad, is, you know, that technological divide versus you and I having a convo. So, you know, how you say something to me depends on how I perceive it.
Yes.
But when it,
and how you perceive me.
Yes, how I perceive you and how I perceive the message. But if you send me a text, I can have a very different reaction to exactly the same words. Not like that's ever happened.
No, I don't know what she's talking about, everybody.
And so it really surprised me the number of messages that as professionals we've been using for quite some time in one form or another that were really not well perceived. So that was very eye-opening for me and has actually changed the way I think about talking about certain things. And then the other side of that, you asked me what we confirmed that wasn't surprising. That's a good one. I think, well, another one that actually surprised me was that we could so accurately detect the volume of food intake from these devices, from chews and swallows. I honestly thought they would never get close to weighed food records. And they are so close, it has blown my mind.
Wow.
So two things surprised me, one technological, one behavioral. The thing that didn't surprise me is, or that we confirmed, is that people eat very differently in the lab than in real life. So when we give people the choice to eat whatever they want in the lab, it is very, when we do the study where they eat one day in the lab and then 2 days on their own, very different how they eat in the lab than on their own, which we know from former studies is likely to happen. And again, it's about the context thing, who you're with, where you are, how you feel about it. Are you distracted? You know, if you come into the lab and eat, you're just sitting there eating. It's boring. If you're reading a book or if you're on your phone or you're talking to someone, it's a different story. So we have confirmed that the way you eat is very different in a lab setting versus real life, which is why getting to what people are really doing is really the important part of what we're doing.
It seems like even the real life part, if I know that I'm reporting back to you and I've gotten to know you a little bit as the researcher that's working with this study, I'm going to want to please you. I'm going to want to do better than my normal. Are you seeing that too, that the short term, okay, we do lab for a day, we do outside for 2 days, and then we do a 20-day follow-up or something where it's more vague. Do you see some differences there as well? Almost when you're more at an arm's length, they're not checking back in 2 days later with you?
You would think so, and I think it is highly variable depending on the study population. I can give you an example from a study we did several years ago in children with type 2 diabetes. And a lot of those families had extreme family dysfunction and real problems. I mean, real life problems. So we had parents that were addicts, and we had one of our kids that went into rehab by the age of about 14 or 15, for instance. There were families that had, and this happens not just in this study, there are definitely, you know, people in the world that have family members with bipolar, right? But they're trying to go to school, they're trying to cook for their family, care for a parent. There's so much going on in these families. And you would think that they formed a really strong bond with us because the study went over about 10 years.
Wow.
And even the kids and families that never took their medication, never followed up on any of the dietary advice, they came to all the education sessions. They came to all the outcome visits, knowing their diabetes, you know, knowing they've done nothing. They still came because of the strength of that relationship. So you would think that those would be the people, the strength of that relationship for years, where we had never gone a month not contacting them. You would think that they would have the most reporting bias for desirability, right? To say what they thought we wanted to hear, especially because we've been talking to them about diet and exercise for years. And they did not. They were about as accurate as everybody else, I would say. Huh. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's really hard to tell. I think it's population specific.
Let's talk about you. How is your life different based on the research that you've been involved with? Not just the last 10 years, but over your career. Have you had some kind of mile markers along the way where you made this discovery and you made a change and then you made this discovery? How is your research integrating into your life?
That's a great question, I think. It is more behavioral than I could measure. So it's things about learning how other people perceive food and exercise and weight and self-image. I've done some anorexia nervosa studies as well in the past. And it's taught me a lot about the spectrum on which these things can be thought about, not just measured. You know, I'm talking about measuring them. It's changed the way I talk about eating, the way I talk about exercise, the way I talk about maybe being overweight or underweight. So it's had a really profound effect in my perception of both normal weight, overweight, underweight, and how people feel about it. And to me, that's a really profound change. And I don't know that I would have really had that without going through all and doing all the research that I've done.
So thank you for bringing that up. I think this would be a huge tip for every one of our listeners, whether it's friends, spouses, kids, et cetera. Is there some language utilization? Is there some phrases to avoid, utilize some sensitivities to be more tuned into? Like, you've talked about how it's changed you. Can you give us a few tidbits on how it can change us and the way that we're communicating around a very sensitive subject?
I think that's a great question. And again, it's so hard because it really is person specific. There are people that go, don't beat around the bush, right? Just tell me how it is.
Right.
But in general, you don't know that about most people right up front. You do about your family members, but maybe you think, and I know this has definitely happened in some families that I know from some studies, you think it's okay to say my kid's fat or my sister's fat because you've always said it. Your family's always said it. You think it doesn't bother them. It actually really might bother them and have a profound lasting impact for their whole life for some people. And so I think really just when you say things, say them as, I think it's about not sounding judgy, to be honest. Really just say things very matter-of-factly. How do you feel about your weight, right? Rather than saying, how do you feel about being fat? Or how do you feel about being too skinny, right? They're very judgmental, scale-driven. You can say, how do you feel about your weight? Right. And then if there are people, you know, we've had people in our studies who are overweight who are fine with it. This is who they are and they love themselves. That's great. Right. And they can tell me that. But then there are other people that have always been called fat. And you say, how do you feel about their weight? And they don't feel good about it. And so it's also a chance to use language that resonates with them once they tell you how they feel about it. And this is a really good thing to do with your family members, no matter how you've spoken about it in the past. Ask the person how they feel about it. That's my major number one takeaway. Ask someone how they feel about it.
And with that, how do you feel about it? And how would you like me to integrate it into the conversation? Do you want me to completely leave it out? Are those conversations part of it too? Obviously, if they're talking to a nutritionist or a coach, they've come for that help or something related to that. And they're going to be directing that coach and that nutritionist on why are they here. But if you're talking about a parent, a friend, a coworker, is it none of your business until they make it your business? Or what do you think?
Again, there's a spectrum of relationships there.
Yeah.
And just because someone else pokes fun at their own weight or their own behavior doesn't mean
that's
you should. Because I was one of those people that, they poke fun at themselves. It's fine.
Right.
it's not always fine. So to actually ask in a discrete time, hey, you mentioned this the other day and it was hilarious at the time, but how do you feel about it? You know, was that a protection mechanism or do you really find this funny kind of deal? So I think that, yeah, you're right. If people come to you as a patient, they're expecting you to talk about it and to talk about it in a very professional way. It's much harder with colleagues and family and friends, particularly as there's probably a way it's always been talked about, right, which may or may not be an acceptable way to do so.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Beautiful. I remember the question I was going to ask, and this would be a great way to kind of tie a ribbon on this. Future development. So you have this vision of where you're going, the potential. Let's jump forward a decade. The technology's there. You've got the grants, you've got the support, it's working, it's small enough for anyone to wear, it doesn't affect them. Where do you see this leading you and the research that you're involved with 10 years from now?
I love that question. I think that, you know, as technology goes forward and changes all of our lives, a lot of people are wearing Oura rings, yeah, or smartwatches. I would see this combined into that kind of technology where any of us can use it to think about our eating, exercise, and sleep patterns for whatever's optimal for us. Again, you know, certain people with cystic fibrosis need to eat more fat, right? So it'd be great if they could do that without having to think about it all the time. People with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, wouldn't it be great if they didn't have to carb count, if they could just hold their watch up or take a picture on the camera, on the glasses, whatever the device is, and the insulin's automatically delivered for them. This is something people never get a break from. They never get a holiday. They have to think about this every day forever. Some people from the time they're very young, 3, 4, 5 years old through, you know, 60, 70 years old.
Yeah.
So I see this as integrating for health, disease, whatever your goal is, that it integrates into your smartwatch, your Oura ring to look at optimal sleep, physical activity, social interactions. I would like that to be part of this, you know, not have you spent too long alone today? Because right. We know that that's becoming an issue too.
Absolutely.
And what you eat and how does it all fit together? So I see this eventually becoming just a lifestyle tool, just like we went from landlines, you know, with the dial that you went all around the dial.
Yes, I do.
to having a computer in your pocket that you can look anything up at any time, right? And you can get more information for your own benefit and your own well-being. So I, in 10 years' time, I'm sure that will be part of a larger suite of non-intrusive technology that lets you live your best life, whatever that means to you.
Love it. Okay, we're going to need updates. So we have to get you back. We'll talk this through. Let's hear what's going on, how that technology is going. But thanks for joining us. This was fun.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you again, Brad. I'll chat to you soon.
Sounds great. I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Higgins present her insights at an exercise science seminar last year, and I knew she'd be great. Really appreciate her joining us today. If you've been considering pursuing your MBHWSC approved certification as a health and wellness coach, it might be worth looking at catalystcoachinginstitute.com for details about an upcoming cohort we have going on. It's a big decision. So please, if you'd like to talk it through with someone, reach out anytime to our chief learning officer. She'd be happy to set up some time to answer all of your questions. Email is susanna@catalystcoaching360.com. Again, that's susanna@catalystcoaching360.com. And now it's time to be a catalyst. This is Catalyst Coaching 360, Dr. Brad Cooper. Make it a great rest of your week, and I'll speak with you soon here on the next episode of the Catalyst 360 podcast, or maybe over on the YouTube coaching channel.